Hi there, welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Great to have your company again. Today on the program, a review of those French elections. The first round was last weekend. We've got the next weekend coming up. Will Marine Le Pen's populist rise encourage other insurgents across Europe, including Nordic nations? And is Norway a good role model for Britain post-Brexit? Plus, as ASEAN leaders gather in Manila, we'll assess how Southeast Asia is responding to China's rise. What happens if the 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, what happens if they can't be a forceful collective body to address the threats of a more assertive Beijing? What should the US and Japan do? And how do we fit in? Stay with us for my discussion of ASEAN and China. So what did you make of those French elections? It's exciting stuff, isn't it? Next weekend, Marine Le Pen, she's the far-right populist who's just resigned as leader of the National Front, she'll take on Emmanuel Macron, the centrist reformer. Now, the smart money is on Macron, but who can be sure these days? Let's get a sense of the political situation in not just France, but Norway of all places, and Britain as they depart from the European Union. Ulf Sverdrup is the director of the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. He's in Canberra this week as a guest of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Ulf, welcome to ABC Radio.
Thank you.
What's your response to the first round of the French election results?
Now, it was not that big a surprise. Macron and Le Pen were projected to proceed to the second round. So in that sense, it was not so surprising. But in the run-up to the first round of the election, it came pretty close. And I think this will be an exciting second round of the election. And Macron looks in a good position to proceed.
Yeah, the overwhelming conventional wisdom is Macron will win the election on May 7. And he has the establishment's backing. But Marine Le Pen, nevertheless, has tapped into widespread anxieties throughout many parts of France, not just in the southern base where the National Front has done very well traditionally, but also in the northern part, which is a home, used to be the home of the socialists. How do you account for her success so far?
I think in Europe in general, not only in France, there's a big discussion about identity politics and also the way forward. Both Macron and Le Pen share basically a concern and a frustration about the status quo. Both recognize that France has to develop and make some significant changes, but their candidates disagree very much in what would be the right way forward. Madame Le Pen is pursuing a nationalistic agenda of protectionism, whereas Macron is very much more of a modernist reformer pursuing an open agenda. So in that sense, they agree on the difficulties of the present situation, but they disagree very much on the way forward.
Yes, because Le Pen seems to be making this campaign about Macron being the epitome of the establishment in France. You know, he supports Brussels and the European Union. He's a free trader. He supports identity politics. Can you see her resonating with more disillusioned conservatives and socialists who are just fed up with business as usual in Paris?
Yes, I understand that. But at the same time, I treat Macron as a bit of a disruptor. He's not part of the political establishment as it is commonly perceived. He has a new political movement that was just designed a year ago. And he is pursuing a campaign and a style. And also his policy reform proposals are quite radical. So he's also a disruptor in some sense. So it's a big shakeup of the European political party system, and we see this in many other European countries as well.
Of course, though, that a lot of the European elites will be very happy if Macron wins, correct?
Yes, and that would pave a way forward for future European stability, whereas Le Pen win will create a lot of uncertainties, certainly in the EU and the prospects for the European Union.
Yeah, on this program, Ulf, over the last 2 years, we've been talking a lot about these nativists, nationalists, populist insurgency movements that threaten to undermine established parties all across America and Europe. What do you think are the distinguishing features of these nativist groups, and do you think that they'll be a spent force after the Le Pen's likely defeat?
I think during the last few years, particularly since the financial crisis and the austerity policies, the contract between the voters and the politicians has been broken in many European countries. So it's an expression of deep distrust in political elites that we see in many countries. And also I think that political parties used to be the mechanism for mediating frustrations and mediating enthusiasm. But these political parties, they don't play a strong role anymore in European politics. And this is what we see. So it's, in some sense, a crisis of political representation happening in Europe. It's not only about the EU, it's also at the national level. So there's distrust towards the EU, but also distrust towards domestic national institutions.
Yeah, and you saw Trump, obviously the circumstances were different in America. We saw it in Brexit to some extent, we're seeing it in France. We recently did a segment on Holland, and we're seeing it throughout parts of not just Western and Northern and Southern Europe, but also Eastern Europe. We haven't done anything on Norway. Has the rise of populism throughout Europe, has it escaped Norway?
Not only Norway, but also the Nordic countries in general have their share of this. But I think there are some differences, because in the Nordic countries, we see world trade, global trade, open economies as basically being beneficial for our economies. And also that open economies and trade has been seen as important for in order to fund future welfare arrangements. So in that sense, we have pursued policies in the Nordic countries where we are pro-trade, pro-economic integration, but at the same time being very attentive to how to we have distributed the benefits generated by global trade. So we have more equalities.
Tell me about the Centre Party and its somewhat charismatic young leader. Like Macron, I understand he's 39, but unlike Macron, he's not part of the financial establishment. He's a farmer, right?
Yeah. He's a farmer. So there's a party in Norway of farmers called Center Party. But we have very few farmers in Norway. But in terms of political representation, they are still quite popular. And you're right. And during the last few years, they have increased quite a bit in popularity. And I wouldn't say they're pursuing a nationalistic agenda, but they're pursuing a policy of a bit more, let's say, picking up on some of the frustrations unfolding or political sentiments moving in other European countries, and he's being less open to trade, for instance.
Right. Well, what distinguishes that party, the Centre Party, from the Norwegian Progress Party? Because that's also populist, isn't it?
Yeah, but they are more economically liberal, but at the same time, more concerns and restrictive towards migration and immigration. So they are, let's say, welfare patriots somehow.
Yeah.
A bit concerned about distributing welfare benefits to others.
Uh-huh. Well, Norway is going to the polls in September of this year, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Do you think these populists will do well in your elections?
Yeah, today we have a government of a conservative party that joined by the Progress Party, but it will be a very close election, it looks like, where this blue-blue coalition will have to fight very closely with the Labour Centre Party coalition. So it will be a very close call. But what puts it apart is that these fringe parties, so to say, will not be governing alone. They will be governing with all the mainstream parties.
Uh-huh. Not dissimilar to Germany to some extent.
Yeah, we have a big tradition for minority governments and also to some kind of consensus-based politics.
My guest is Ulf Sverdrup. He's the director of the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. He's in Canberra this week. Ulf, Norway voted no to joining the European Union, what, back in 1994? Question, any regrets?
No, I think a majority will not support EU membership now. But it should be said that Norway said no, or a majority of Norwegians said no to EU membership in 1994, but never said no to European cooperation. Or never said no to European integration.
That's a key distinction to make, isn't it? Because some Brexiteers are having that very debate right now, aren't they?
Yes, and I think that the Brits should have quite a bit to learn from looking at Norway, how we have related to the EU. One thing is that they could look into copying our model, legal institution model of relating to the EU. But perhaps even more importantly, that you have to recognize that you can fairly easily get out of European representation or a seat at the table. But it's very difficult and even undesirable to get out of European cooperation or integration.
And just to keep everyone here in the loop, what we mean here is that London's right now is consumed with debates between hard Brexit and soft Brexit, meaning how much of its newfound independence Britain will surrender back to Brussels in exchange for how much access to the European market. And the interesting thing about Norway, Norway is not part of the European Union, but you're a member of the European Economic Area, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That basically it makes us members of the internal market in the EU.
So you like Switzerland, is that right? You're not part of the European Union, but you have free trade agreements with the Union that are still subject to a host of, you know, restrictions and limitations on trade compliance, right?
Yeah. Switzerland and Norway have slightly different modes of association, but the big picture is that both Switzerland and Norway are very closely integrated into the internal market. And for Norway's part, this is not only related to the single market. We also have lots of agreements on research, on cooperation, on migration, on policing, foreign policy, military security issues, etc.
So Norway could be a model here for Brexit, but what about immigration? Is Norway and Switzerland the right answer here? Because immigration and border control, they were increasingly cited as one of the main reasons for why the Brits wanted to leave Brussels.
So both Norway and Switzerland have more or less free movement of persons. So in that sense, this does not fit what the UK wants. And I think that it would be very difficult to separate free movement of persons within the EU and then kind of taking that part out and then continuing the full participation in the single market. The EU would insist they don't accept that kind of cherry picking.
That's interesting. Finally, Russia. Norway is a neighbour of Russia. You had high tensions, of course, during the Cold War. That's well known. Tell us briefly about the relationship between Norway and Moscow in the post-Cold War era.
So during the last 20 years or so, Norway has invested a lot in cooperating with Russia. And this has been very good. And we have been huge successes in this because in the high north, Norway shares a border with Russia. And there's lots of resources in that area. We have huge fish stocks, fish areas. It's oil and gas in those areas. And of course, this is an area of lots of military activity, so it's very important to have good cooperation to avoid misunderstandings, etc. In addition to that, we have seen kind of opening of borders, so with lots of people-to-people exchanges in the high north. So up until, let's say, 2013-14, this has been a very well-functioning cooperation, and it's been very promising.
What changed in 2014?
Lots of things have changed in Russian politics in general during the last few years, but this came to a peak somehow with Crimea and the Ukraine incident, where Russia all of a sudden basically pursued a policy of challenging and changing territorial borders in Europe. And this was a sea change to what we have seen before. And it, of course, created a lot of uncertainties about the intentions and capacities of Russia.
Yes, but we're seeing a vibrant debate in many European countries, not so much in the United States, but certainly in Europe, we're seeing some skepticism of the idea of isolating Russia over Ukraine. I'm not just referring to the Le Pens in France and other more nationalist, nativist movements. I'm thinking even mainstream politicians like the former German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, they would argue that Russia's activity in Ukraine has been reactive, that it's been defensive in response to provocative Western moves to expand the European Union and even threaten to expand NATO right up to Russia's doorstep. How would you respond to that counter-argument?
I don't see NATO as pursuing a policy of expansion as such. But I understand that Russia had some concerns, and I think in retrospect, both Europeans and Russians and the Americans had quite a bit to learn from how to pursue policies in these, let's say, border areas. But that doesn't justify unitary military action, etc.
Uh-huh. But I mean, the counter-argument would say that, you know, Russia is still a great power. It's a declining great power, but it has legitimate security interests, and they see Ukraine as a buffer between Russia and the West.
Yes, but returning to what you said earlier, Norway is not pursuing a policy of isolating Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good policy, and that's not what we would like to do. But we'd like to have a policy of cooperation with Russia based upon some joint principles.
What about Russia making moves into the Arctic, Ulf? I've read reports that this is worrying Norway and that they've increased defence spending. Is that right?
Yes, in some sense. But you have to take into account that Russia is the most important Arctic power, right? The whole northern shore of Russia is an Arctic shore. And of course, Russia has legitimate interest to protect as the ice cap is melting and the geopolitical landscape in that region is changing. Now, but we should also take into account that one of the few ice-free harbors of Russia is very close to the Norwegian border. So for geostrategic interest, the areas close to Norway are important for Russia.
Mm.
So Russia is increasing the military capacity in the area, and Norway and all the NATO countries are also responding to that.
Mm. Ulf, thank you so much and all the best during your time in Canberra.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Ulf Sverdrup, the director of the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. He's been in the country this week as a guest of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade.
On RN, this is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Well, it's been 9 months since an international arbitration tribunal rejected China's claims to most of the South China Sea and its creation of artificial islands. You may recall it was a victory for the Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei. They all had territorial disputes with Beijing.
The decision in The Hague fueled celebrations on the shore of Manila Bay. In a ruling that's been hotly anticipated since the Philippines took on China in 2013, a tribunal of the Permanent Court of Arbitration found in favour of the island nation. The tribunal said China's attempt to claim almost everything in the South China Sea by drawing the so-called nine-dash line around it is meaningless in international law.
But what's really happened since The Hague's ruling against China? And how has ASEAN responded to China's growing assertiveness? Well, as it happens, the 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, they're meeting in Manila this weekend. Amelia Long is a researcher at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and an editor of The Strategist. She's also co-author of Tiptoeing Around the Nine-Dash Line, Southeast Asia After ASEAN. Hi there, Amelia. Welcome to RN.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
What's been ASEAN's response to the Hague's tribunal's ruling last July?
So ASEAN's response to the Hague's ruling has been lackluster at best, due largely to the consensus-based decision-making process that's core to what's known as the ASEAN way. So in Laos in July 2016, Cambodia again refused to support any official dispatch that was particularly negative about Chinese actions in the South China Sea. And this time it was in relation to the Permanent Court of Arbitration's ruling.
Well, why is it that Cambodia, and I think Laos is the same, why do they side with Beijing on these maritime disputes?
So ASEAN's member states have traditionally been divided over whether maintaining territorial integrity and protecting national sovereignty are more important than the aid and investment that they receive from Beijing. So Laos and Cambodia are two such countries where China's no strings attached aid and investment might sway their ability or willingness to actually be able to stand up to China over its military involvement in the region or support their ASEAN partners, perhaps in the way that they would wish them to do so. So as an example of that, so Cambodia has actually on several occasions blocked ASEAN from making a strong or collective statement on the South China Sea.
Yeah, there was a famous case, I think, in 2012 when Cambodia hosted these ASEAN meetings and China successfully lobbied Cambodia to avoid mentioning the South China Sea dispute at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then the foreign ministers in their meeting, they didn't even come up with a joint communique because my understanding is that it's ASEAN orthodoxy for the last four decades to always come up with a joint communique, and here's Cambodia vetoing it essentially.
Until it was first requested of ASEAN to reach consensus on the South China Sea in that initial meeting in 2012, ASEAN actually held a remarkably strong track record at taking a united stance on issues relating to politics and security. The South China Sea issue in 2012 was actually the first instance where they weren't able to.
Well, it sounds like ASEAN's, they just can't reach unanimous agreement on the South China Sea. Question, how weak and internally divided is ASEAN?
It's difficult to say weak because, of course, ASEAN has made such strong headway in what I'll call lowest common denominator issues. So they have been relatively successful in tackling issues like people smuggling or counter-piracy or counter-terrorism or humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. And they've also been very successful in creating the ASEAN economic community. But on politically sensitive issues like the South China Sea, where a major economic stakeholder like China, you know, could be behind states pulling the strings, ASEAN states are going to have a lot of difficulty staying united.
It's widely regarded that Cambodia and Laos are more or less client states of the Chinese. But what about the Philippines? I mean, it is a US treaty ally, and Manila won that legal victory over China last July. But under President Duterte, it seems like the Philippines are changing their tune. What's going on there?
So Rodrigo Duterte has certainly been more sympathetic of China and appears to be much less willing to work with the United States to counter Chinese claims in the South China Sea.
And yet this is the same bloke who campaigned on a pledge to get on his jet ski and go to the Scarborough Shoal and tell the Chinese what he really thought of them.
And just in the last couple of weeks, he's been ramping up his rhetoric about sticking a Philippine flag right in the middle of the Spratly Islands. But he's actually had to put a stop to that after a request came through from China that he should be halting his efforts.
What's the feeling in the Philippines? I mean, because they had this big victory against the Chinese last year. The government of Duterte seems to have been sending mixed signals about China's growing assertiveness.
So it's my sense that the Philippine defence establishment in particular, the Defence Secretary, Delfin Lorenzana, he is clearly unwilling to roll up a bilateral alliance with the United States that's, you know, extremely well established and has also been, you know, very useful in helping to dent the activity of militant groups in areas like Mindanao, as well as generally safeguarding and promoting Philippine national interests. So how that is going to conflict with President Duterte's erratic behaviour, it's going to be very interesting to watch.
Do you think there's a growing consensus among these ASEAN countries that China is not just becoming more assertive in the region, but that it will inevitably overturn the regional status quo? In other words, push America out of the region?
I certainly think that that's the case. That's the crux of the competition between the United States and China in the Asia-Pacific. One party wants to maintain a liberal, predictable and stable rules-based order that's really characterised the region since the end of World War II, while the other party's focus is on a secure and prosperous region, but that probably doesn't place the same emphasis on rule of law and human rights as the current status quo.
To what extent are there doubts among these nations about America's staying power? Because you often heard doubts raised about the Obama pivot towards East Asia. But Trump, in his early months as president, has reaffirmed America's security presence, certainly in Northeast Asia. Are there doubts about America's staying power among ASEAN members?
I think that those doubts would probably have existed before the Trump administration came to power. So it probably wouldn't be as new a phenomenon as a lot of people would think. Probably more personal issues between President Trump and ASEAN states that wouldn't have been in existence with the Obama administration. For instance, President Trump's very anti-Islam rhetoric that he espoused during his campaign trail. But of course, there's also other issues that have arisen since the Obama administration. For instance, Malaysia in particular is a little bit wary of its closeness to the United States after America's investigation of President Najib Razak in the Malaysian financial scandal.
Yeah. My guest is Amelia Long. She's the co-author of a new ASPIE report, Tiptoeing Around the Nine-Dash Line, Southeast Asia After ASEAN. Now, Amelia, you write that the Americans, the Australians, the Japanese, they've all been active in seeking to curb China's spreading influence in Southeast Asia.
Yes.
Question here is, how successful has Beijing been in using ASEAN as a way of getting its way against Washington?
So China using ASEAN to achieve its goals in realising its national interests has probably been about as easy as the US, Japan and Australia using ASEAN to accomplish the same thing, which is not entirely effective. ASEAN states, of course, while they are seeing the benefits of Chinese economic investment, they also see value in the security guarantee in the liberal international rules-based order that's been upheld by the US. And as such, we run straight into the consensus-based decision-making roadblock once again. But of course, how ASEAN states feel about the US may have the potential to alter that balance. But of course, that's an entirely different issue. China is in a position where it can use ASEAN's traditional remedy of sweeping politically sensitive issues like the South China Sea under the rug to its advantage. So either claimant states reach an understanding with Beijing on a bilateral basis and unilaterally renounce their sovereignty claims, which would likely take place in exchange for a benefit like preferential economic treatment. And that's something that people are considering might be the case with the Philippines. The alternative to that is that, of course, the most powerful state, which is China, will win out and use its force to expel rivals from the contested areas. So either way, China gets its way with the South China Sea. So it has been able to use ASEAN as leverage to achieve its national interests.
If ASEAN can't be relied on to act forcefully against the Chinese, as you seem to suggest, what then should the US, Japan and Australia do?
So there's a good chance that the US will likely return to its traditional policy of interacting with Southeast Asian countries on a bilateral hub and spokes basis. Although that's not an ideal situation and a bit of a rejection of multilateralism, it would at least allow for focused agreements on support for defence reform in Southeast Asia. They could still further American strategic interests in the region. So, you know, I'd look, for instance, to Malaysia or the Philippines or Thailand or Indonesia for that kind of partnership. Mm. Australia and Japan are in quite a different position to the United States. And I think that their primary goal should be ensuring that the US remains actively committed to the region, which, of course, there's been a lot of debate about that being up in the air at the moment. It's simply unrealistic to expect that ASEAN, Australia, or Japan, or any combination of the three, could act as a credible and forceful counterweight to China on their own. The only state that's really capable of doing that is the United States. Mm.
And yet the consensus seems to be that the Trump foreign policy really is a work in progress.
Australia, no doubt about that.
And there's no question Australia remains solidly behind the Americans. After all, it has been our most important treaty ally since the onset of the Cold War in the early 50s. But is there a danger that a piece of the scaffolding might fall off and hit us if we remain too close to Uncle Sam, especially if there's a skirmish with Beijing?
Of course, I think it's reasonable for us to be concerned about being collateral damage. The Trump administration is an inexperienced one, and we should keep a close eye on it as it attempts to find its feet on the global stage. But I think that it's very important for US allies like Australia and Japan to see that lack of clarity around the Trump administration's perceptions of the Asia Pacific and how that squares with Trump's America First rhetoric. We need to be looking at that as an opportunity. Australia and Japan are both in a very fortunate position where we can try to shape and influence the state of the US engagement in the region, and building up robust regional partnerships like the Australia-Indonesia bilateral, for instance, will help us really to secure America's interest. So we're hearing a lot of debate at the moment about how important it is that Australia starts thinking about implementing a more independent foreign policy, for instance, by remaining firm on the defence spending target of 2% of GDP. But even if we do choose to stick to that 2% goal, there's ultimately no credible security substitute for the US in our near neighbourhood.
Mm-hmm. Amelia, thanks so much for being on Between the Lines today.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
That was Amelia Long from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Between the Lines. Remember, if you'd like to download this episode or back issues, or send us a comment, just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompt to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Hope you can tune in again next week.